Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode number 510, woo, of the Bold and the Brave Her podcast. Today, I'm joined by someone very special. Basically, I stalked him, and I finally found him after I read a phenomenal article about the silent treatment in the New York Times. I'm honored to be joined today by Dr. Kip Williams. And Dr. Kip Williams is an expert in something that's kind of wild and crazy, and he'll tell you more about it. And that is ostracism. And basically, the silent treatment goes right in there with it. Yeah, that's right, girlfriends. You heard me. We've all done it. We're going to be hearing more about it. And right now, what we have is a professor emeritus from Purdue, who is on the faculties of multiple universities, been all over the place, and is a pioneer and world-leading expert on the social and psychological dynamics of ostracism. And he had a phenomenal book called Ostracism, The Power of Silence, also co-edited at least 12 other books on the subject, and is literally considered the go-to person on this entire topic, which is why he is here today. Kip, welcome aboard.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So what I've done is I read this pretty amazing article in the New York Times. It was very timely in many respects. And it was called, This Habit is Quietly Ruining Relationships. And it's all about the silent treatment. So obviously it was clickbait. It was a good title. And it got me, I mean, hey, you know, busted. And the first quote was from you. And it was all about what this is. It made me sit back and think to myself, and I am a physician and a clinical investigator. So what I really love is I love to look at the biology and the physiology of what goes on in such a psychological play, which is something like the silent treatment. So first, what I'd love for you to do, because you have such an amazing history, is go back to that time when you were walking your dog, and all of a sudden you got hit in the back with a frisbee. And this is when you were just beginning to put together a lot of this thought that you had about the kind of science you wanted to do. It's always something, you get hit in the back with a frisbee. But why don't you tell us what a scientist like yourself did with that experience? First, the experience.
Okay, well, let me just preface by saying, as you did, that I was already interested in ostracism and had been since 1978, after I'd watched a documentary about a cadet at West Point who had gotten silenced for 2.5 years. And I did want to study it in the lab. I'm an experimental social psychologist, which means I do experiments. And I was looking for some way to bring people into my lab and randomly assign half of them to be briefly ostracized and half of them to not be ostracized, to see what impact that had on them. And I was with my dog at a park. It didn't actually hit me in the head or in the back. It just rolled up to my blanket. I turned around, noticed there were two other guys sort of waiting for it. So I got up and threw it back. I figured that was it. And I was going to go sit down again. And to my surprise, they threw it to me again and they kind of included me. So I joined them. We stood far enough apart. We weren't talking to each other or anything like that. And I think it probably, we were throwing it for maybe a couple minutes. And then for reasons I still don't know, they stopped throwing it to me. And at first I thought they were teasing a little bit or kidding, but after a while it was pretty apparent they weren't going to throw it back to me. So I felt awkward and odd and went back to my dog at the blanket. I was glad I had a dog at my side. It gave me some kind of a connection. And then I was also glad that I was interested in studying this phenomenon because I realized right away how powerful this little episode was and that it was pretty content-free. We weren't talking. We weren't friends. We weren't anticipating future relationships. We were pretty much just, or at least I was, a stranger to them and felt like a a gut punch. It was something I actually felt physically and thought, well, this is something I could actually do in the lab, something like this, where I bring people in, initially include them in something, and then stop completely and have the interaction with the other people continuing, and then seeing how that affects them in terms of the way they think, the way they feel, the way they act. And down the line, we were actually looking at physiological measures as well as how it affects the brain and other aspects of the biological person. So yeah, it was sort of a fortunate misfortune or whatever that happened. And I've sort of used that method for over 30 years now.
Wow. So is the silent treatment a type of ostracism?
I define ostracism as ignoring and excluding. We often think of a group ostracizing an individual, but an individual can ostracize an individual could ostracize a group, and groups can ostracize groups. So as long as it's ignoring and excluding, I include that in my definition and include behaviors that have those aspects to them. So the silent treatment is something that we usually reserve for relationship, dyadic, often relationship kinds of phenomenon. They don't have to be, but I mean, that's how we use it most typically. We give our partner the silent treatment, or somebody at work's giving us the silent treatment or something like that. And it is being ignored and excluded.
What is the purpose in your mind of doing the silent treatment? Is that all about control? What's happening?
Well, I think that might be a derivative cause. I don't think that's necessarily the conscious cause, but I think that we do it for different reasons. First of all, there's not just one simple reason that we do it. So a lot of people do it because they're angry, they're hurt, they're mad, their feelings have been hurt, or sometimes they're so struck by whatever just happened that they don't even have words and they just find themselves giving the silent treatment, in which case it's almost not even deliberate. It's just something that they watch themselves do. And yeah, I do think it ultimately affects or is a controlling type of a behavior, but it does other things too that are just as powerfully painful as taking away control from another person.
When I read your work about the pain issue, I can't tell you how much that resonated, because I discussed this with some of the members of my team and some colleagues, and they all just raised their hand saying, yeah, painful. And it's not just like a little mental angst and then you blow it off or something. It's like someone just sliced your wrist. It's that kind of thing. So what I want you to share, if you could, because I think people need to know this, before you give the silent treatment again, you better think very carefully about what you're doing here, because this is really harmful. It's extremely harmful. So you did some incredible experiments with the MRI, the magnetic resonance imaging scanning. So tell us about that.
So I used a method that came from the Frisbee incident, and we developed an online game called Cyberball. And on the screen, you see two cartoon characters throwing a ball, and then you see your hand, or in some cases, you see the back of a cartoon character representing yourself. And you've been told that the experimenters are interested in mental visualization. This is a cover story so that you're not told we're interested in how you feel when you've been ostracized. And we say, you know, not everybody's good at mental visualization, so we'd like you to play this game for a couple minutes. And we don't care who's getting the ball and who's throwing the ball. Just mentally visualize who these other people are, where you are. Are you outside or inside? What's the weather like? All this kind of stuff. But unbeknownst to them, they are randomly assigned to get the ball about a third of the time, because there's three of them playing, or to get the ball a couple times at the beginning and never again. So it turns out that that method lent itself to MRI, fMRI research, because they don't move. They can just click who they're throwing the ball to with their fingers. And that's one of the stipulations of doing that research, is the person's head has to be very still. So we were able to actually use that paradigm, that method of studying ostracism, to see what does it look like in the brain when people are being ignored and excluded. And what we found is that the same region of the brain that is activated when people experience physical pain, like putting their hand in ice cold water or experiencing super hot temperatures or getting a pinprick or having pressure applied to your fingers or whatever, that this pretty much the same regions that are activated for those physical types of pain are activated when people are not getting the ball during cyberball. And we only have them play for a couple minutes, and they don't know the people they're playing with. They're strangers, and they don't anticipate meeting these people. So we think this is a pretty scaled down version of ostracism. Most of the times when you're ostracized in real life, it's by people you know and care about, which is going to amplify the impact. But we know that just simply being ignored and excluded by two strangers in this game is sufficient to cause the brain to feel pain.
That just blew my mind when I thought about it. You know, it's one of those sticky facts that just won't, you know, it's just now glued to my brain. I think about that. And we've all been guilty of a little, you know, come on, the silent treatment.
Oh, absolutely. When I give lectures, I ask them, I say, how many people in here have gotten the silent treatment from somebody you care about? And it's almost always everybody raises their hand.
And how many people give the silent
treatment?
Well,
then I say, now be honest, how many of you have ever given the silent treatment to somebody you care about? And then begrudgingly, about the same number of hands go up.
They just go up slower. That's
yes.
All.
Yeah. They kind of look around to make sure other people are doing it too.
Yeah. Like,
it's something we all get and we all do.
So is there like a personality that tends to use the silent treatment a lot? You know, you've studied this. And so what kind of a person kind of uses this in their toolbox as a, like a regular default?
Okay, so I want to preface this by repeating that almost all of us do it and almost all of us get it. And so if you are giving it, that doesn't mean you have that personality.
Okay, that's fair.
So this is for people who chronically use it, who use it as their first way of dealing with any kind of disagreement, let's say, and that they don't try to talk things out, they don't try to discuss things or they just immediately go to the silent treatment. So there are people who self-report that they do routinely, chronically use the silent treatment on their relationship partners, on their kids, on their parents, on their siblings, in the workplace, you name it. So people who chronically use it all the time as their first method of disagreement tend to be high on, so there's the big five personality. I don't know if this is something you've talked about in other of your other episodes, but there's two of the big five are agreeableness and conscientiousness. There's extroversion and neuroticism and one other that'll come to me in a moment. But the people who score high on disagreeableness, on the agreeability dimension, that they're highly disagreeable, and people who are low on conscientiousness tend to be people who are more likely to chronically use the silent treatment. But again, most of us use it occasionally. Just because you've used it doesn't mean you have that personality trait. But people who tend to use it all the time are more likely to score in the range of high disagreeability and low conscientious. There's a corollary to this, which we find to be sort of amazing, is that there are some people who chronically get it. They get it at work, they get it at home, they get it at school, they get it in their relationships. So whereas most of us get it occasionally, some people get it all the time in all kind of venues, they also have that same set of traits.
So the giver and the receiver, that's so fascinating.
It is fascinating. I was sort of blown away that to think that the same traits predict both. So yeah, that's an interesting coincidence or not, but it's something that we can use to describe both chronic givers and chronic getters.
So, you know, you said that this person who tends to chronically give it, you know, the silent treatment, is someone who is not as conscientious, you said, right? What does that really mean?
So conscientious means that you are reliable, that you follow through on your promises, that you are someone that can be relied upon to do what they say they're going to do. And so if you're low on that, that's low on conscientiousness. And then agreeableness is pretty much as it sounds. It doesn't mean necessarily that you argue. There are people who are good arguers and that aren't necessarily low on agreeableness, but it's somebody who doesn't appreciate or doesn't care about achieving harmony amongst in social relationships. They actually kind of seek disharmony and things of that sort.
Interesting. I've also heard that it's sneaking into the workplace a lot more.
Ostracism is common in the workplace. Whether it's more common now than it used to be is an interesting question that I don't really know if we have the data to speak to. But if we did, I kind of have a reason why that could be the case, because a lot of the other ways of behaving towards each other in uncivil ways are more easily monitored and trackable. And so you can get in trouble for, let's say, calling somebody a name. You can get in trouble for spreading rumors if you leave a paper trail. You can certainly get in trouble for physically assaulting somebody. And companies can get in trouble for punishing you, like by taking money away or sending you to some unpleasant place in the building or some other city. So ostracism is actually allowed to slip through because it's a series of non-behaviors. You're not doing something you're not doing. You're not doing
so they something. Can't accuse you of something you're not doing.
Right. So you're not looking at somebody. You're not answering somebody. You're not inviting somebody to a gathering or a get-together or whatever. And so it's harder to monitor and to form rules about. So it's easier for people to use and get away with it. Just as an example of this, if you're giving your partner the silent treatment, and you're out to dinner with several couples, you can get away that entire evening without the couples know that you're giving your partner the silent treatment, but your partner will know. And so you can be gregarious and friendly and funny and all sorts of things and just never look at your partner and never respond to them, but respond to everybody else. And you've gotten away with hurting them and looking good all at the same time.
It's kind of a horrible win-win.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you get down to it, I remember in one of your prior interviews, you mentioned something, I believe, about a couple, you know, a man and woman who've been married for 40 years. And at some point, for whatever reason, why don't you tell us a story?
Well, they were in their 20s and we were interviewing the woman, but she was now in her 60s. She said she and her husband got in an argument when they're in their 20s, and she can't even remember the content of the argument. And he stopped talking to her. He stopped looking at her. He stopped eating meals with her. And she thought this would pass, and then it didn't. And then she tried to be apologetic and nice and friendly and all these sorts of things, and that didn't stop it. She started insulting him and calling him names and doing things to provoke just to get a response. That didn't work. And so he continued to give her the silent treatment for 40 years. And then he died. Never again did they talk to each other or eat together or do things together.
Even when he died? In other words, was she there at his side when he passed away?
Well, she wasn't giving him the silent treatment. So she probably went to his, I don't recall, but it was he that was giving it to her after, and she tried in any number of ways to get him to stop doing it. You know, we did ask, why did you stay in that relationship for so long? And she said, at least I had a roof over my head. And so over time, you start to internalize the message that you're worthless and you're not worthy of attention or concern or respect or liking. And so she just felt that at least she had a place to live.
When I heard that story, when she literally just said, I put up with this for 40 years because, you know, I had a roof over my head, I fell off my chair. I was, what?
It's similar to anybody who stays in an abusive relationship.
That's correct.
If that abuse is physical abuse or emotional abuse, that at some point you just start to think less of yourself and that maybe you deserve what you're getting. And then you just have a very low self-esteem. It can lead to depression and all sorts of things like that. So yeah, I actually had a student the other last year who asked a question that nobody had ever asked is, why did he stay in the relationship? What is he getting out of that? Oddly enough, that question never occurred to me either. But yeah, it's just as intriguing.
Well, he got a caregiver.
I guess, but it couldn't have been a good relationship for either one of them.
Well, no, this is a toxic relationship. Let's just call it what it is. I mean, but man, it just blew me away. The other one was in the military. You had a couple of examples. You know, there was clearly one where, you know, the poor kid, when he was in the military academy, they have that incredibly tight, rigid rules. And if you don't put your pencil down during a test, exactly when they tell you, and he was just a tad slow, he did nothing more than that, then immediately everyone ostracized him. And here's the question I have for you, right? What they're trying to do is drive him out of there, like go away, right? But he didn't go away.
Yeah.
He hung in there for 2 years.
Two and a half,
sorry.
Just even longer.
What's half a year between friends when you're ostracized? Yeah. And then he went on to have a military career. Now, here's what's interesting. There's him. Then there's another one that just blew my mind, but didn't surprise me, sadly and tragically. And that is, you know, someone who did nothing wrong. Nothing. Right. But was ostracized for the 4 years.
Right.
And the one thing he was black.
Yeah. General Benjamin O. Davis. And he was one of the early first black cadets. And they didn't want him because of that reason. They ostracized him from the moment he arrived. And he persisted.
He went on to become a general.
Well, yeah. Yeah. He had
you know, he was incredible. Now, here's my question. When you're unfairly ostracized, and I would call the first example with the pencil very unfairly. I'm sorry. That's just that doesn't pass my sniff test for the way things should go. But regardless, what kind of personality hangs in there when you're surrounded by people ostracizing you?
Yeah, and that is a very good question. And I have to admit, it's still something that needs to be researched. We think that it's a cluster of traits that we might call resilience.
There you go.
Or grit. The ability to jump back on the horse when it bucks you off and just persisting. But, you know, when those two characters that we're talking about, they're very different from each other. It's kind of hard to look at the two of them and say, oh, they're very similar in their personalities. I don't think after reading a lot about both of them that that's the case. But yeah, we don't. You can imagine when you're doing experiments, you can't sit there and ostracize somebody for 4 years in a lab. That's unethical, right? Some of these questions you can't test experimentally. The best way you can do it is just through surveys and interviews and things of that sort. But we think it probably, you have to maintain a reasonably high self-esteem. You need to have some form of sense of belonging outside of the venue in which you're being ostracized. So Benjamin O. Davis, he talked a lot about his weekly phone calls with his family. And so I think having that connection, that sense of belonging with others, even though they weren't there at the academy, kind of allowed him to survive that treatment. Having a sense of self-worth, feeling of belonging or connection to somebody else can stave off the resignation effects that we see for a lot of people when they've been ostracized for a long time.
The Her Podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative, holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about her life stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. What is the difference between ostracizing and just leaving someone out of something because they're assuming that, let's say, for instance, I remember that I'm not a golfer. I'm actually a triathlete. I do other kinds of sports. But golfing, you know, maybe sometime in my life, whatever. Right now, it's not clicking. So I found myself, as I oftentimes do, as being the only woman in a group of men as I am hanging out with some of my Wall Street friends. And they all started devolving into, you know, golf talk. Yeah, it's the golf talk. You know the gig. And I just, no one acknowledged my existence right then. You know, before that, we were talking business, whatever. But then it was just golf talk, and they really didn't care that I was not contributing. No one was directing anything at me. It was almost like that cyberball thing. It's like for a while, I was getting the cyberball, you know, and then all of a sudden, I'm out of it. I didn't feel, as it were, ostracized, but I didn't feel included. What's that?
We've studied that. We call it being out of the loop.
Ah.
So, you know, the intention is very different. They're not necessarily trying to punish you. They're talking about something. It doesn't have to be golf. They could have all gone to the same movie and you didn't see it. It could be some news item that you don't know about. It could be something that they did with other people that you weren't a part of. But even though it's not probably intentionally punitive, it has the same impact on us, that we see the same threat to four fundamental needs. You feel a lower sense of satisfaction and belonging. Your self-esteem takes a hit. You feel like you don't have control over the situation, as you pointed out earlier. And then you feel unacknowledged and a low sense of meaningful existence, we call it. And so just being left out of a common topic is sufficient, just like being not getting the ball thrown to you, to threaten those four fundamental needs. So even though it's different in terms of the perceived intention of the people doing it, in terms of how it affects the person that it's happening to, it's very similar.
It's so fascinating. And what about ghosting?
To me, ghosting is just a popular term that is another way to say silent treatment or ostracism, but it seems to be more focused on social media, texting, to some extent emails, although who emails anymore, apparently I do, but social media, any kind of dating sites and things like that, you just get no response. It's like you've been ghosted. And so we have studied that as well and find that has similar impact on people. It can be very frustrating.
And painful.
What I think might be not as intuitive is that sometimes when we've talked to people who ghost, like on dating sites, if it didn't work out, they'll just ghost. And they reason that they don't want to put any effort into it. This is part of the process, and that they don't want the person lingering and hanging on. What they don't realize is that some people get very angry when that control has been stripped away from them, and no explanation and no closure. So there are some people who can become very physically angry and emotionally and physically, and can do things because they're getting the silent treatment, because they're ghosted. So it isn't necessarily the safest response to reduce someone lingering on.
I think with the very fragile personality, someone who's kind of, you know, on the edge and everything, if it hits the wrong person, I would assume they could also be violent. They could be all kinds of things, basically reacting and lashing out when they feel like they've been dissed like that. So let's go to a relationship situation, because I know my audience is all about that. How can we stop ourselves, as it were, from doing this silent treatment thing when we've used it before? It doesn't feel good. It shouldn't feel good when you're doing it. It certainly doesn't feel good when you're receiving it. It's not good. This is a not a positive coping mechanism when things are not going swimmingly in the relationship. So how does someone stop this?
Right. Again, some of this is just from my years of experience in talking to people rather than from experimental research results. But we find that sometimes when you give someone the silent treatment, it's self-perpetuating. That to stop giving someone the silent treatment is almost like admitting you are doing something wrong. And so you have to kind of re-amp up the reason you're doing it to maintain it so that you're not saying, oh, I was being unreasonable here, or I was being childish or something. So you just keep going. You keep it going, and it lasts far longer than you may have ever thought it would have lasted. There was a father who was, this was in Australia, and they use the term gobsmacked, which is a cool word, but we don't use it over here in the United States. But he was so appalled at something his son had said to him that he just found himself giving the silent treatment. And he goes, I didn't intend to give it for a long time, but I stopped talking to him. I stopped answering his questions. I stopped including him on the family meals. And I saw what it was doing to my son. He was becoming a spineless jellyfish, and I really thought it was going to do harm. And it was doing harm, but he says, I felt like I was in some kind of psychological quicksand because I couldn't stop doing it. I think that gives us a clue as what we possibly could do if we find ourselves leaning towards using it. So if you're so upset that you can't talk, and sometimes, you know, I think we think, I'm not going to say, if I talk right now, I would regret it. I would say things that would be hard to take back. And so I could do irreparable damage if I did talk or engage. So I'm going to, it seems like a reasonable thing here to say, I'm not going to talk. Well, I think that is possibly a reasonable thing if you go, I'm going to go out on a walk. I'm going to take a ride. When I get back, let's talk. By doing that, you two things. You separate yourself physically from somebody, because when you're giving someone the silent treatment in their presence, it's an ongoing, obvious norm violation that you keep having to justify, and it makes matters worse. If you leave, then the person can think about other things. They're not in your face. You're being ignored and excluded. But the other thing is, you can give some kind of a endpoint. You can say, I can't talk to you right now. I'm so upset. So give me a day. Let's talk tomorrow. Or, you know, depending on if it's a coworker or somebody that you're not going to see for a while. Or if it's your partner, you know, give me a couple hours, or I'm going to go to a movie, or I'm going to, you know, go play golf, or whatever it is. I'm going to go do something. When I get back, we can resume. And it gives you a way to re-engage that giving the silent treatment without that endpoint doesn't.
I love that. Obviously, one of the biggest issues is communication. I mean, that's why silence is not golden in this case. You know, where I think that in a relationship, it's incredibly important to remember that communication is the glue. That's what keeps everything together. And when you suddenly ghost the other person, basically, disappear, take off, don't say a word. And I think your point is extremely well taken. Just be human. Like, something happened that just blew you away in a not great way. It's hard. You want to wrap your head around it. You want to understand it. You want to process it. And you need time to do that. I'm a real fan of saying, you know something? We're hitting the pause button. It's all about the pause button. And someone actually gave me one for Christmas. It just hit the damn thing. But, you know, you hit the pause button and just simply say, you know, I'm like kind of blown away right now. I need a little time to process this. And I'm a huge fan because I'm athletic and I like to be outdoors as much as humanly possible. So I'm a huge fan of going out for a walk or a run.
Exercise,
or
yeah.
And anything.
I can do all kinds of good things. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, all those, get those little endorphins, you know, churning around and back and forth. And, you know, I'm a firm believer and a crazy person about basically the walk and think. And we have solid, really wonderful published research that shows creativity increases, the ability to cope, resilience increases, to your point about resilience. Yeah, I love that. I think that's very cool. You know, a lot of us, I'm a woman and I came through medicine at a time where I don't have any female predecessors, right? And so there were really interesting times when you feel as though you're not quite included. It's, you know, I get along with doorknobs. I mean, I get along with everybody, you know, so it's not an issue. It's not like she was burning her bra at every 5 minutes. No, I kind of like roll with it, you know, one way or the other. But just like little, how do I say this, little micro silent treatments or micro, you know, separations that take place, I think that those over the course of time add up as well. But I'm a real crazy person about resilience. I'm a nutcase about communication because I've been busted just like any human being out there. I've screwed it up royally, epic failures in the ability to be able to communicate optimally. But, you know, what I love to do is take it as a life lesson. Like, how much more can I learn? That's why when I stumbled on your research, I had never seen anything like it. Thank God for that New York Times piece that came out. Obviously, it was about relationships and how the silent treatment gets. But I was like, whoa, let's dive deeply here. And your research is absolutely stunning. I'm not here to kind of blow up your head, but if your head blows up, that's what happens. I'm just saying that it's elegant. And I've read quite a bit of your research now. And it really helped me understand that behavior feels painful like physical pain when it manifests like this. Yeah. And actually, tell us about the Tylenol experiment.
Okay, that's not mine. That's a research
or somebody,
Nate DeWall at Kentucky. But they were sort of taking this idea that if the brain is using the same neurological apparatus to detect and experience emotional and relational pain as it is physical pain, then would things that reduce physical pain also reduce emotional and relational pain? And so they gave people a substantial amount of Tylenol or a placebo and found that they were less negatively reactive to cyberball ostracism than those with the placebo, meaning that they experienced less pain. I want to caution this because I think it's a really interesting experiment. It needs to be replicated, but it speaks to the overlap, the pain overlap theory that researchers were interested in. Is there overlap in the neural architecture between physical pain and social pain? And yes, apparently there is. But I don't see it as a solution. It's not like, this is what you need to do. If you're getting the silent treatment, take a lot of drugs, you know. And there's been research with marijuana and psilocybin mushrooms and alcohol and you name it. And yeah, they can deaden the pain. They can also deaden the pleasure. And so it's not a, I don't think it's a wise way to deal with it. I think the best way to deal with it is to feel the pain when it's happening and then seek social connections with others. If the one that you're with isn't giving you one, your siblings, your friends and things like that. But yeah, so I'm a little Larry talking about the Tylenol thing, because sometimes I think people take it in.
All right. So we'll back off the drugs. So give us just the easiest way you feel it coming on, the silent treatment. Do you do something physiologically? Do you take those three deep cleansing breaths? Do you, because you've got something mounting inside of you and you want to protect yourself to a certain degree. So you go quiet. And all of a sudden, there you are facing the silent treatment potential.
Right. So we're talking about the person that's giving the silent
treatment.
That's
correct.
And when you find yourself doing it. One thing I should say is that some people think, oh, isn't that just a passive aggressive response to people? But it's not passive in the sense that it's actually very depleting. It depletes you of the ability to think and the ability to deplete your emotional, your ability to rein in your emotions. And so it's difficult to maintain and to continue, which is, again, why I suggest that if you feel like that's how you're going to respond to somebody and you find yourself doing it, remove yourself from the situation physically, I think is maybe the first step. But I also think it's great if you could preface it with an end time, because I think both of those things will get things back on track and allow you to communicate at a later point. It allows you to cool down, to think, to maybe do things that are healthy for you, but it also doesn't lack the endpoint, which sometimes causes a persistence of the behavior because you don't want to admit that you were wrong to use it. So you just keep getting angry to justify doing it, and it keeps going on and on and on. So something that gives an endpoint.
I'd love it. Just take yourself out of it. But before you do that, you can go running off. Just say something. Just say something. You know, wow, this is a lot. I need to process it. I'm going to go take a walk or whatever. And I'll be back with you when I feel like my... In this way, the person isn't just standing there going, well, what? And I think that that's important. You know, this has just been a ridiculously wonderful interview with you. You're so damn smart about this, about something that I think everyone needs to understand. And that's this whole silent treatment, leaving people out. It's so physically and mentally painful. Don't do it. Stop it. There are other ways to deal with it. And we went over those today. I want to thank you, Dr. Williams. Dr. Kip Williams, who has written the book on this and who has done such pivotal and seminal research in the field, for helping shed light on a very common behavior and one we could do a lot better at. Thanks, Kip.
Thanks for having me and enjoy the conversation.
And I want to thank my sponsors, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs Rooted in Nature, and the new Her Life Stages products by Solaray. Scope it out at solaray.com. And hey, take a minute to leave us a review, because we love to hear from you. This has been a production of Podcast Health. And remember, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there, seize the day, little carpe diem, people, please. Thanks for listening and viewing. Bye-bye.